Today's Taisho will be on Case 13 in the Mumonkan, the Gate of No Barrier. Tokusan holds his bowls. One day, Tokusan went down to the dining room holding his bowls. Seppo met him and asked, "Where are you off to with your bowls? The bell has not rung, the drum has not sounded." Tokusan turned and went back to his room. Seppo mentioned this to Ganto, who remarked, "Tokusan is renowned, but he does not know the last word of Zen." Tokusan heard about this remark and sent his attendant to fetch Ganto. "You do not approve of me?" he asked. Ganto whispered his meaning. Tokusan said nothing at the time, but the next day he ascended the rostrum, and behold, he was very different from usual. Ganto, going toward the front of the hall, clapped his hands and laughed loudly, saying, "Congratulations, our old man has got hold of the last word. From now on, nobody in this whole country can outdo him." Mumon's comment: as for the last word, neither Ganto nor Tokusan has ever dreamed of it. When you look into the matter, you find they are like puppets on the shelf. Mumon's verse: if you realize the first, you realize the last. The first and the last are not one word. The main figure in this koan is Tokusan, great Tang Dynasty Zen or Chan master. Tokusan is the abbot of a large temple and is quite renowned throughout China for the depth of his insight and the quality of his practice. So monks come from all over China to practice with Tokusan. And, you know, if you do Zen practice a little bit, if you're new to the world of Zen and you begin to stick your toe into the water, so to speak, you'll begin to notice that a great deal of emphasis is placed upon doing things a certain way, doing things properly. For example, when we have our meals at Sesshin, at our meditation retreats, we have nested bowls. We have a bowl for the rice. Traditionally, a second bowl would be for like miso soup, and a third bowl for vegetables. So we have three bowls, one fitting inside the next. And then we have chopsticks on top, and on top of the chopsticks there's a white handkerchief, which is supposed to be folded square. And then there's a cover. And when we have our meal time, we all leave the zendo, the sitting room, and we all go in a line and we sit in an assigned place. And somebody leads the sutras. And as we recite the sutras, we unpack the bowls in a certain way. And we arrange the bowls in a certain way. And then the food is served in a very specific way. And of course, after you eat, then too, everything is cleaned up and packed up in a very specific way. You can often tell what day it is in the sesshin just from the way people unpack their bowls. Really, it's true. You know, the first day it sounds like all hell has broken loose, right? Because these are plastic bowls, and in traditional Japan they'd be lacquer bowls. But lacquer bowls are very expensive, and a bowl is a bowl, you know, they look all right. And so people are undoing their bowls, and it's like clatter, 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 you know, this incredible clatter. And people don't even notice it, because usually during the first day of a sesshin, it's often the case that, you know, we naturally live in a mentally very distracted place. Our society is like a samsara squared. So, you know, you watch TV, you read the news, you know, there's music on the radio as you're driving to work, whatever. Mind becomes rather crude. So when you come to Sesshin on day one of Sesshin and it's the first meal, the bowls are clattering and people hardly notice sometimes, you know, because there's such a screen of mental interference, so much jumble. And so basically we do zazen all day, we go to sleep, we get up and we do zazen all day, go to sleep, we get up, we do zazen all day. Just so those of you who haven't been understand, we have meals, there's bathroom breaks, there's time to rest, but there's a lot of meditation. It's not quite as difficult, by the way, as the Saturday sit. If you do the whole Saturday sit, that's tougher than the morning of any Sesshin. That's tougher than in any morning of Sesshin. Because in the Saturday sit, we have no break, right? We sit straight through until noon. In a Sesshin, you'd have chances to get up and stretch more than we do here. Even though we get up a little earlier, I think the Saturday sit is really tougher. So I know a couple of you have come to the Saturday sit here for the first time, and at least one person is here, I think, for the second time. You've done a wonderful job. In other words, you're still here. Basically, I want you to know that Sesshin's not actually as tough as this. But Sesshin is very good for purifying the mind. And by, say, day three of Sesshin, you can see, you can hear, and you can see quite a difference in how people unpack their bowls. Because there's much less rattling around and clattering. And, people are much more attentive, just naturally attentive, to taking the bowls out and putting them quietly on the table. It's like the mind has become more fully in the moment, more aware, and there's this great clarity, you know. And so you pay attention, and you're at one with your bowls as you undo them to a greater degree than you were on day one. And this is part of Zen practice. You know, Genki Roshi, my first teacher, used to say that he could tell about a monk simply from the way the monk put his sandals against the wall. So, he would look at the shoes behind the divider there and just shake his head, you know, because we'd come in and we'd dump our shoes down, there's a big jumble of shoes, and Genki would think that's not mindful. And, when he was in Japan and he was teaching other monks, he would just look at how they'd arrange their sandals. And if their sandals didn't have this mindful quality, you know, he thought, well, tisk tisk, you know, this person's not really practicing. Maybe practicing on the cushion, but not deeply enough to notice that these details have to be taken care of. So in Zen tradition, generally speaking, a great deal of emphasis is placed upon doing things properly, and that doesn't just mean following the rules. It means doing things mindfully in the moment, and doing them mindfully in a natural way, which is rather complicated, because if you're trying to be very quiet as you take the bowls out of there, you undo the nested bowls, you'll probably make more noise than ever. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but if you're really trying to walk quietly in the house, you know, you often will make more noise. Or if you're really when I have terrible handwriting, and the worst thing I can do is really try to write neatly, because the handwriting just gets worse and worse, you know. So self-consciousness doesn't really help. If you're at a Sesshin and you're thinking, oh, I've got to move these bowls very quietly, that's when you knock your chopsticks into the air or something with your left hand, or drop them on the floor. You're straining to be mindful. But sometimes if you've been sitting for a number of days, you just become mindful. You don't have to strain. You're just present in the moment, and you take the bowls out, and there's this wonderful quiet as everybody does this. Many things are like this, you know, in Zen practice. You begin to become quiet again. Okay. So this is the temple of Tokusan. He's the teacher. He's the Roshi. He's the master. So if anybody is supposed to be attentive and mindful and in the moment, it's Tokusan, right? He's the one whose shoes are always impeccable, right? Always in the, arranged in a way that's totally mindful. When he comes into the Zendo, he never forgets to bow. He bows impeccably, you know, and so on and so on. All of this is just excellent. People look at this and think, now there's a Zen master. Right? So one day, a very strange thing happens. In a traditional Zen temple, people are called to eat. So when we're sitting in the morning at Sesshin, we sit until clappers go off. Clap, 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 right? And then the person who's leading the sit hits the bell, everybody gets up and goes in to have a meal. So you're summoned into the meal. And in a traditional temple, bowls are not left on the table, they're left behind your seat. So everybody would lean back and get their bowls and stand up, and you hold your bowls in your hand and you walk into the dining hall. Okay. So anyway, one day, old Tokusan is moving toward the dining hall with his bowls in his hand. Seppo, a monk, a senior monk at the temple, met him and said, "Where are you off to with your bowls? The bell has not rung. The drum has not sounded. See, what the hell? You know, what are you doing?" Tokusan, who's an old man, right, turned and went back to his room. It's like, did Tokusan make a mistake? You know, he wasn't mindful. You know, he forgot. You don't just walk. You know, he forgot. It's not mealtime. So Seppo mentioned this to Ganto, another senior monk, who said, and Ganto says, "Well, you know, this is a real faux pas. You know, he's supposed to be a great Zen master, but he's just made a terrific faux pas. Tokusan is renowned, but he doesn't know the last word of Zen. See, he doesn't know the last word of Zen. So he's good, but he hasn't got it." He hasn't got it. So Tokusan somehow heard about this remark and sent his attendant to fetch Ganto. And he said to Ganto, "You don't approve of me? You don't think I'm awake?" And Ganto whispered his meaning. Tokusan said nothing at the time, but the next day, when he had to give Teisho, he ascended the rostrum, and behold, he was very different from usual. Ganto, going toward the front hall, clapped his hands and laughed loudly, saying, "Congratulations! Our old man has finally got hold of the last word of Zen. From now on, nobody in the whole of China can outdo him." So now he's got it, the last word of Zen. So this is the koan, right? Koan is the last word of Zen. And once again, I hope all of us have the chance to do this wonderful koan together. Possibly when I say I hope we all have the chance to do this wonderful koan together, it might be exciting to you. I'm hoping that it will pique your interest and make you want to practice. On the other hand, it might be depressing to you, because you might be sitting there saying, "That koan, I haven't even gotten through the first koan yet." Yeah. You might be sitting there thinking, "I don't think I'll ever get to that koan at the rate I'm going." And you might feel a kind of, dissatisfaction or unhappiness, because you haven't answered all these koans yet, you know, and you don't know the last word of Zen. Yeah? Let's face it, in a way, when we come to practice, I mean, all of you got up today and came here to sit. And some of you got up early. You might have had to drive from up north and come down here. You might have had to get up at 4:30 or 4 o'clock or and drive all the way down here to sit. And, you know, he's sitting here all morning. And, you know, possibly, you know, the reason you came, maybe, is because you want to wake up. You know, you want to wake up. You know, all day long we feel all day long, you know, we go through our day, we may feel the absence of being awake. You know, you might find yourself fearful, angry. You might be reminded in a million different ways that you haven't heard the last word of Zen. And so, you know, come here to practice because that's the goal. You want to have a dai, we say dai kensho, great awakening experience. And, you know, that impulse is very important. You know, I actually think it's quite important to feel a kind of a sacred discontent. You know, many people are quite happy with the lives they lead, and that's fine. But sometimes a person will be living a life, a so-called normal life, and will begin to feel that something is really missing in that life. And, you know, begin to look sort of high and low for what's missing. And it may not be a conscious thing. You know, it may not be something you think, something's missing in my life. But you begin to find yourself looking for something. You know, and you begin to feel, again, you might not put it in so many words, but there's a sense that something's missing in my life. You know? And I think this is just wonderful. It brings people to the cushion. It makes them get up on Saturday morning. So this is really quite important, this sort of sacred discontent. You don't have to say it's sacred, but it's really important, right? I mean, I think all the good things that humans have done come out of this discontent. You know, I mean, there, you know, people have always been sick, right? You know, humans are usually sick. And everybody is going to be sick, and eventually sick to death, right? It's going to happen. But all the same, you know, in history, there are people who, you know, have gotten tired of everybody being sick. And they've said, you know, we could do better than this. And, you know, created Ayurveda, or Western medicine, penicillin. It's a sort of discontent produces something positive. And I think the arts are like that. You know, the arts are you know, there's a kind of discontent, which is very good for people, you know, to not be satisfied with misery, unhappiness, you know, anger, fear, violence. It's, you know, or a simple life of simple, you know, self-indulgence and dishonesty, mere, you know, ordinary self-indulgence and dishonesty. You know, so it's wonderful when people begin to feel this discontent. But on the other hand, you know, this can also have the effect of draining away your appreciation for your practice. If all the time you're feeling like there's a goal to be achieved, and you can't achieve it, it's very far away and you're very far from that goal. You know, so there's a kind of balance in Zen practice where, you know, we know there is something, or we believe there is something called awakening. This is what the Buddha experienced, it's what all the great Zen teachers have experienced. They have these experiences and they say they've been transformed by them, and we believe them. And so okay, there's that. And pursuing that is really important. And I think when the energy goes out of that pursuit, it's not good on many levels. You know, you'll see in the arts, for example, periods where just nothing's going on. You know, if you take a survey course, you'll take a survey on, say, you know, Western art, from the Greeks to the Impressionists. And there are periods where it's just like everybody's doing the same thing and they're sort of painting with one hand tied behind their backs. You know, it's like nothing's going on. And then all of a sudden you turn the page and it's the Impressionists. You know, all of a sudden there are these people painting these dazzling paintings that are amazing. You know, Monet, Manet, Renoir, Cezanne. It's just incredible, right? And it is true, they didn't come out of nowhere. Somebody came before them, but they brought things to life, you know, in this amazing way because they were discontent. So you know, there is this energy that comes from discontent, and if it goes away, everything sort of goes flat and stale. And you can see this sometimes in Buddhist practice. You know, it's very important to have a everyday practice. You know, to appreciate everyday life through your practice. It's very important to try to be mindful as you go through the day. It's very important to make sure your bowls are nicely arranged when you eat your meal. But if you lose sight of the goal, which is enlightenment, awakening, it all becomes very artificial, very lifeless in a way. You know, this is in various moments in Zen history, this has been a big problem, where if you read Master Lin Ji, if you ever read the record of Lin Ji, the Lin Ji Lu, or in Japanese it's called the Rinzai Roku. If you ever read the Rinzai Roku, you know, Lin Ji is living in a time which is sort of the end of the golden period of Zen. And he comes into the monastery and he says, listen, you guys, you're all sitting on the cushion, but you're not really trying to wake up. You're just trying to get through the sit. And he says, you know, you get up every morning and you eat black beans and rice and you go take a little nap and then you come in and you sit and you're just killing time, you know. You're not really trying to wake up. And he really tried to inspire people to pursue the goal, enlightenment. And because they had grown content with sort of just like going through the motions, just trying to be happy on the cushion, you know, the energy and power of their practice disappeared. And indeed, after Rinzai, for about a century or so, there was a real period of decline in Zen practice. This happened in China too, and Master Hakuin revitalized Zen by saying, wait a minute, we're not going through the motions, we're about enlightenment here. Okay, so all of that's true. You know, it's important to pursue awakening with a kind of passion, right? With a passion. You know, we want to be enlightened. You know, that's, and I hope that passion, you know, makes you wake up sometimes at 4 o'clock in the morning and say, okay, I'm going to sit, or 5 o'clock in the morning, or six, that's okay. But at some time, right, you say, I'm going to sit because I want to wake up. I don't want to be in samsara forever. But on the other hand, you know, it's possible to lose touch with the moment, you know, with the beauty of the moment, the beauty of this moment, and the beauty of practice from moment to moment. You know, it's true there is such a thing as daikensho, but it's also true that every moment is daikensho if you can just harmonize yourself with the moment. Right? And this is quite important. You know, there has to be a kind of attention in your practice. That's just the way it goes, you know, at least in the Rinzai tradition, you know, where we want to wake up. But on the other hand, how do you wake up? Not by running madly about, but by harmonizing yourself completely with the moment. You know, so, you know, I have talked about this before, but when I go, at the end of every evening, I go around and I say to people, how was your sit? You know, and I actually hope that you had a wonderful sit. But you know, a wonderful sit could be a sit that works like this. I come in, I sit down on the cushion, and my knee starts bothering me. And then I realize that I have a report due, and that I'm probably going to have trouble making that deadline, and I begin to get more and more tense as I think about it. I keep trying to come back to my breath, but this tension is increasing. And all through the sit, I'm thinking this and that, and at the end of it, I'm not really sure what happened.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's a typical sit. That's a typical human sit. And it may seem like nothing was accomplished, you know. But actually, very important to live life, you know, just to live life. And when you go through something like this, you know, when you go through a sit like this, it's not as though nothing is happening. It's just not what you expect. It's not what you expect. Some people come to Zen practice because they want to get away from their troubles and their stresses and their fears and anxieties, and they imagine that Zen practice will work like this, you know. They'll come in, they'll sit on the cushion, they'll watch the breath, and they'll bliss out, right? And it'll just be bliss, 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 and the bell will ring, right? But you know, actually, if that were Zen, it would be very bad for people. Zen really would be like a drug. If that's what practice is all about, it was really like a drug, it'd be dangerous, and people shouldn't do it, because it's like, you could go rob a bank, you could come in, sit on the cushion, enter bliss, you know, I feel better about myself now, and go on with life. But actually, what generally happens on the cushion is, you know, when you're watching your breath, your mind does become calmer, even if you don't think it is. You know, as you're sitting on the cushion, the mind does become calmer. Even if you don't think it's calmer, it's and when the mind becomes calmer, all of a sudden, whatever is in there springs up in front of you, you know? Springs up in front of you. And so if you're frightened, something's making you anxious, there's your fear. If you're angry, something, you know, has made you angry, there's your anger. You know, you know, if you're feeling brokenhearted, whatever, you know, you might have come to the sit expecting like instant consolation or instant remedy, but, you know, really, Zen practice is about working through these karmic obstacles, working through these karmic events. So you watch the breath and you follow the breath out, and then these thoughts arise and you go back to the breath. This process is like cleaning up your house, like cleaning up your mind, right? And at the end of the sit, even if it feels like you didn't accomplish anything, probably at the end of the evening, you're calmer than you were. Your mind might not be empty. You know, you might not be radiant. Sometimes we have these sits where it's just like heaven, right? You sit on the cushion and it's like heaven. And it's just radiantly marvelous to be in the moment because all obstructions are gone temporarily, you know? And that's nirvana. That is enlightenment, that state. But, you know, often, for various reasons, we accumulate karmic baggage. We accumulate events from the day that have emotional and resonance. And we don't get to enter that beautiful, luminous clarity. We have to huff and puff and work through the karmic obstacles. And, you know, when we're huffing and puffing and working through the karmic obstacles, it might look pretty good to know the last word of Zen, right? It's like, boy, I can't wait until the day when I have no more of this baggage. You know, I can just sit on the cushion and be like the Dalai Lama. You know, just boom. You know, bliss. Bliss, 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 bliss. I'll know the last word of Zen. You know, and there's some truth to that, but If you think that way, you're not really living, I think, as fully as you can, the Zen life, you know. Because honestly and truly, there is, you know, I'll tell you the answer to this koan right now. It won't help you when we do it, you know. But there is no last word of Zen, you know. There is no last word. If there were a last word of Zen, what would be the point? See, that you misunderstand Zen. You know, when people are 16, 17, 18 years old, you know, they leave their parents' world and the world of like high school. And I don't know how it was for you, but I come out of the 60s, and I went to school in the 60s, high school in the 60s, and where I went to high school was really the 50s, right? So that might not mean anything to you, but the point is, everybody had it all figured out in the town where I lived in high school. I lived on a military base, actually, but I went to high school in Yorktown, Virginia, which was a small provincial Virginia town. And in the high school, you had the military brats, that is, myself and these people were bussed from off the base, and you had these people from this small southern town. And they had it all figured out, right? You know, everything was, you know, everything. If you were a nice young man, this is how you dressed. You wore loafers with pennies, and girls wore pennies and loafers, boys didn't, I'm sorry. You wore like Farrah slacks to school, and like a Oxford cloth shirt, you know, maybe, or a white shirt. We still used to wear white shirts sometimes. And, you know, you combed your hair, and you had short hair, and you combed it, you know, and it had a part in your hair. You didn't part it in the middle, you parted it on the side. You know, school was very clear what you were supposed to do in school. You know, my parents were very clear about things, you know. You know, it was all laid out. So, you know, when I got to college, I really wanted to bust out of all that. You know, I really wanted to see something new. I just thought, oh, that's nonsense. You know, that's all a bunch of nonsense. You know, I don't have to cut my hair every week. I can let it grow long, you know, and I can put on blue jeans with bell bottoms, you know, and I really went for all of that stuff because I felt like I was breaking out. You know? And I think maybe people still go through this, you know, when you leave your home, your parents' home, and you so you go through this period where you're leaving behind all of these values you were taught, and then, you know, interestingly, people want to embrace a new set of values that are very clear-cut. You know, psychological researchers say that when people are in, say, 17, 18, 19, 20 years old, they want, believe it or not, they leave their parents' world, but they often crave certainties, right? They're actually looking for, like, certainties. So it's such a strange thing, I think, about humans, you know. They have a little window in their lives where they sort of experiment often. And then, you know, what they really think they want is certainty. You know? So they want to go back to that world of their parents, that, you know, the world they grew up in where everything was all mapped out. It's just a slightly different world. But I don't think people really like certainty. I think they want certainty. But I don't think certainty is very good for people. Because my feeling is that as you get older, you know, you get more and more boxed in by all your certainties, you know, so-called. And life begins to lose its flavor. One of the things that is so interesting about a relationship with another person is the uncertainty of it. You know, in other words, you know, you will meet people who say, "I'm getting married next week to a woman who's just wonderful. She's just like me," right? You know, and you just scratch your head. Yeah, you know, I don't know what to say. It's like, gee, okay, you know, if that's what you want, right? Now, you know, that's what you want, okay, you know. But, you know, even if you work very hard to marry a man or a woman who's just like yourself, you're going to be disappointed, you know. It's just not going to work out. And sooner or later, you're going to realize that this person you thought you knew is really quite different from the person you thought you knew. And, you know, at that point, a lot of people get divorced, actually. You know, wait a minute, you're not just like me. I want a divorce, you know. But if that doesn't happen, you know, if that doesn't happen, you begin to realize, well, this is, you know, you can go either way. You can say, this is hell and I hate it. Or you can say, you know, this is kind of interesting. you know, this is actually rather interesting. You know, I don't know what's going to happen next. See, you know, I think personally that this is really wonderful, a wonderful way to live. You know, it's a wonderful way to live. I love uncertainties like that. Now, you know, I do like it when I get up in the morning and I go out and my car starts, you know, so that there's certain kinds of things I want to have very dependable. But the deeper things in life, you know, it's really wonderful to live in I think people are quite mistaken when they think they want certainty. They say, oh, I just want certainty. I just want to know. You know, I want to know. I say, really? I don't think you do. You know, I think that's a misunderstanding, you know, because actually we'll never know. We'll never know. And knowing isn't that important, you know, actually. If you look at, like, science, you know, every week, if you read health news in the New York Times, I read health news, you know. So for about 10 years, I've been taking 400, milligrams of vitamin E every morning, because this is what they said was an antioxidant, good for your heart, cancer fighter. So the other day, I opened the New York Times. I don't really read the Times in paper form. I brought it up on the web over lunch, and it said, don't eat vitamin E, whatever you do. You know, it could cause a heart attack or something. You know, it was just one study. It was, you know, it was a statistical study. Nobody knows what it means, right? You know, who knows, right? People have believed that the universe is eternal. They have believed that the universe was created. When I was growing up, they discovered the Big Bang. So they said, it has been created. There was nothing and then there was something. Now physicists say, well, actually, probably there have been Big Bangs over and over again. And some physicists actually think that black holes are universes emerging in another dimension and there's a Big Bang going on right there at that time. So it's like you could think of the universe as all of these Big Bangs happening simultaneously, infinitely in all directions. You know, so we don't know, do we? And we probably never will, see. You know, knowing it all is really not possible. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try, because it's the adventure, see? Every time we try to know something, we encounter the real world. And every time we encounter the real world, we get reconnected with it. Maybe we reconnect intellectually. You know, maybe we reconnect, existentially in terms of personal experience. You know, we Zen people, we reconnect with the world from deep samadhi, from non-dualistic awareness. So we're a little different from the scientist or the artist. We enter a state of non-dualistic awareness and we encounter the moment, see. And it's always a different moment and it's always unknowable. See, we can know it a little bit, but it keeps changing. And, you know, growth and change, when you grow and change, everything changes. You change, your understanding changes. And the things you believed 20 years ago are no longer true. I think absolutely everything can go out the window, you know? I mean, when I was 17, I was so different from who I am now. And nobody who's 17 can predict with any certainty where he or she will be, you know, 40 years later or 30 years later. You just can't predict, you know? And you can't even predict where you're going to be a year from now. Now, one way to react to this is just to get depressed because you feel so powerless. But that's a kind of small self perspective, right? That's a little self perspective, very small view. You know, when we sit on the cushion, we watch the breath until a mind begins to empty out. We work through those karmic obstacles. And we begin to enter a bigger self, bigger life. And, you know, if you're in that state, this constant change, this constant flow is not so terrifying. It becomes tremendous if you let yourself relax into it, it becomes tremendously energizing, tremendously exciting. You're just amazed. This world is constantly changing, constantly unfolding. The whole universe, and we're unfolding with it. And that's really tremendously exciting, I think. And if you let yourself relax into it on the cushion, it's just amazing. It's wonderful. See? You know, I'm an English teacher, and English teachers, English professors, have what we call the canon. These are all the poets and writers worth knowing. And we discovered a lot of them because they had been forgotten. Believe it or not, you know, Shakespeare was pretty popular in the 19th century, but a lot of poets, if you take a poetry course in an English department, a lot of the poets you read were forgotten 100 years ago. In fact, I did my dissertation on a poet named Thomas Traherne, and his works were discovered in a trash can, almost, not really, but he was totally forgotten. And some guy was in the 19th century was going to a used bookstore, and he found this volume without any publication information, and he read these poems that he'd never read before. And he did a lot of detective work, and he discovered this poet people had forgotten for 300 years. He's a great poet. You know, and so English professors try to find all these poets, and we try to put them in special volumes. And we try to bind the volumes in very strong binding. And we make our graduate students read all this stuff, right? Because we don't want them to be forgotten, you know? But in 1,000 years or 5,000 years, they're all going to be forgotten, you know? And I think this is true, really, this is true for everything. You know, who worships Apollo today? Anybody? You know? See? This is just, you know, people hold on. They think they're building for eternity, but that's not so, I believe. There is nothing that is not going to be that is not part of this infinite flow of life energy. And so, you know, one way to practice Zen is to be afraid of change and growth, and to want it all to be over now. I want all to be over now. I want to see old Tokusan. He's got it knocked. He knows it all, right? Everybody in the temple thinks, now Tokusan, he doesn't have any uncertainties. He understands it all, right? He's read all the sutras. He's had Daikensho. It's in the bag for him. And then one day they see him make a mistake, and they think, wait a minute, that can't be right. But they don't understand. There is, you know, it goes on and on. You know, even after Daikensho, it's not like after Daikensho you've seen it all. That's not how it is. You know, people can have many Kensho after Daikensho. That's very common if you really practice. Hakuin Zenji had a number of very significant awakening experiences after his great awakening experience. And one, he said, the last one he had in his life, he said, I realize now everything I thought before was incorrect. You know, that's what he said. He actually said, I realize I've been wrong totally all this time. You know, I see a completely different way now. And this is true with like koans. You know, there isn't like one answer to the koan. You know, you can come back to a koan many times and experience it in a completely different way. You know, the truth is that this dynamic of change is inescapable. It's the way of life. It's the way of living things. You know, wanting things to be permanent and unchangeable and rigid and fixed. Wanting the truth, wanting to know once and for all, this is not healthy, I believe. My personal opinion, this is profoundly unhealthy. It makes people rigid and fearful, and it makes them resist life energy, you know. Just to go back to my own profession, you know, in English you find people who have deep philosophical commitments. And they are indeed like religious believers, you know. So you will meet people who are like Marxists, or there's a group of people called the deconstructionists, right? And there's another group of people called the new historicists, right? And they all have like their, they all have their sacred texts, you know, some philosopher. They all have their liturgies and their methods and their dogmas. And you know, I've lived that way myself. You know, when I was younger, I was a part of a cult called hermeneutics in English. So we all read Gadamer, a guy named Hans Georg Gadamer, big German philosopher, right? And his book is like 80 million, it's like 800 pages long. It's called Truth and Method, right? So this was the Bible. We all read Gadamer, you know, and then, you know, every time you read something, if you embrace something like that and you hold on to it, every time you read something new, it's terrifying, right? Because then you get a book in the mail and you read it and you think, oh my God, this really threatens many of my basic beliefs. You know, I either have to destroy it, you know, I have to destroy it. You know, there must be something wrong with these principles, right? So you start trying to destroy it. You try to find weaknesses, poke holes in it, you know. And the more rigid it is, the more resistant to attack it is, the more nervous you become, you know. And then people actually get depressed, you know. It's like, oh my God, the challenge of deconstruction. What do we do, you know? They have conference papers. How are we going to respond to this, you know? This is crazy. This is crazy. You know, actually, you know, in 10 years, I always say to people, I have these graduate students who go through the same thing. They get all overwrought, they get terrified, you know, they'll, oh my God, the crisis of representation. It's like, get a grip, you know. You know, in 10 years, nobody's even going to remember who Gadamer was, right? You know, he's going to be a historical curiosity, right? Frederick Jameson, these big names in our field, in 20 years, some poor graduate student will have to read this stuff, you know, and do his dissertation or her dissertation on this. Nobody else will even remember these people. It's all very fleeting, right? You know, and that puts it into perspective. You know, you have the bigger view. These are just ideas. They have a purpose at a certain moment, but life is bigger than this. It changes and it grows. And you know, certainty is really not, you know, what we want. We need a certain kind of conventional stability, right? It's like in Zen, you know, you need to know we're all going to eat at noon. You put your rice in the big bowl. You put the vegetables in the other two, you know, this sort of thing. It has a practical purpose. But once you've stabilized your life in that way, once you have a kind of a disciplined, orderly life, you know, you can deal with this beautiful change, this beautiful phenomenon of change, you know, which is the essence of life. And so you know, this is the Zen way, right? So let's you know, when you sit on the cushion, no sit is ever going to be like the last sit. You know, maybe your last sit was like a trip to heaven. You know, but the way to guarantee that the next sit is going to be a trip to hell is to try to have that experience again, right? And you can either enter, you know, you do meet people all the time who have deep ideological convictions. And they're generally nervous, fearful people because they're trying to hold on to their, once you have beliefs, you have to hold them and defend them. It's like, let it go. Let it go. You know, the whole purpose of Zen, you know, there are people who turn Zen too into a philosophy or a way, you know, a set of principles or a dogma or religion, you know. But as I always say, I don't think this is religion. I don't think it's philosophy. It's the Tao. It's the way, you know. It's at least our way, our Tao, is to embrace that infinite change, that infinite process. So you know, every sit is going to be different, you know. And please enjoy it, embrace it. You know, embrace it. It's never going to stop. Every sit is going to be different. You know, every time you have a breakthrough, it's possible to have another breakthrough. And that's wonderful, not terrible. It's not like, just give me Daikensho and let me get out of here, will you? You know, I just want to be done. You know, why? You mean you just want to be dead? Is that what you're saying? You know, because that's what it's all, you know. This is about really and truly eternal life. Life is infinite, eternal, unstoppable, indestructible, imperturbable, right? It's we who create the waves in this beautiful, you know, ocean. So all you have to do is harmonize yourself with your uncertainty, right? The life of uncertainty. So we sit on the cushion, we straighten the back, we breathe through the dantian, and you begin to watch the breath, and the mind begins to go blank. You enter this state of openness, uncertainty, not knowing, emptiness. You know. Something comes up, you know, and all of the old habits kick in, right? All of the old fears, anxiety. You know, this is not what I wanted. This is not going where I want. You know, back to the breath. You know, back to that emptiness. Back to that openness. We learn how to live in that great openness. And little by little, the attitude towards what is troubling us changes. It we begin to experience it as a manifestation of, we say, Buddha nature, life itself, pure life energy, pure sacred life energy. See? And then, you know, it doesn't matter if you have, of course you have problems, you're alive. Of course you have disappointments, you're alive. You know, even people who don't practice have these moments where you suddenly realize you're like an actor. You know, there are moments where you suddenly realize in life you're just playing the role. You're like an actor. You know, you're just pretending to be Kurt Spellmeyer or pretending to be Bob Jones. You're pretending to be upset about your car payments, and you suddenly step back from yourself and you realize, my God, this is just a character in a play. You know, it's. And then you kind of realize the play is magnificent, right? And then you say, well, who am I then? If Bob Jones is just the character, who am I? You know, who am I? So you're really the universe pretending to be Bob Jones. Bob Jones is just the role you're playing in this little play. And you know, sometimes people discover this just accidentally, and it's like this marvelous release. But we experience that in a different way on the cushion, you know. You enter that blankness, and then you begin to see that all of this is like the, you know, to get upset about events in your life is like getting upset at the wind or upset at the changing of the clouds. Now, this is the life rolling on in all its beauty. This beautiful life of uncertainty. I've told this story before, and I've gone on too long, and I'm sorry. I'm sure your legs are hurting. But, you know, a great Japanese master named Soyen Shaku, S-O-Y-E-N Shaku, was invited in 1900 to Chicago for the World Parliament of Religions. And all of these learned theologians gave very complicated papers from different disciplines, not just Christianity, Judaism, Hinduism, and Soyen Shaku was asked to speak, and he said, you know, the problem with modern people is they don't know how to be dumbfounded. And everybody, they thought it was a translation mistake, and they burst into laughter. But he meant just what he said. People don't know how to live in uncertainty. You know, the last thing we really want, I believe, is to know for sure, is the certainty. You know, we need stability, we need self-disciplined life, you know. Then, you know, something wonderful is always going on, right on the cushion. One day, Toku-san went down toward the dining room, holding his bowls. Seppo met him and asked, "Where are you off to with your bowls? The bell has not yet rung. The drum has not yet sounded." Toku-san turned and went back to his room. Seppo mentioned this to Ganta, who remarked, "Toku-san is renowned, but he does not know the last word." Toku-san heard about this remark and sent his attendant to fetch Ganto. "You do not approve of me?" he asked. Ganto whispered his meaning. See, they're both deeply awake. Toku-san said nothing at the time, but the next day he ascended the rostrum, and behold, he was very different. Ganto, going towards the front of the hall, clapped his hands and laughed loudly. "Now he's got it! Our old man has got it. From now on, nobody in the whole country can outdo him." See, he's like pulling the wool over everybody's eyes, trying to get them to practice more. Mumon's comment. As for the last word, neither Ganto nor Tokusan has ever dreamed of it. When you look at the matter, you find that this is all like a puppet show. This is all just a movie. They're all just a play. And they're pretending to be Ganto and Tokusan. Who is really the actor? Right? When we identify with we enter Deep Mushin, unify yourself with change, you become your true self. Right? Mumon's verse, if you realize the first, you master the last. The first and the last are not one word. Not one word is true.